Hello and welcome to the Sheffield Libraries podcast. My name is Alexis and my guest today is lawyer turned novelist Abby Silver. Abby has written the Burton and Lamb series of legal thrillers, which have recently had a facelift ahead of two new stories due for release in 2021. Right, well, thank you for joining us on the Sheffield Libraries podcast, Abby. It's really lovely to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to speaking to you.
Thank you. So can you just start by giving our listeners a little introduction to yourself, please?
Yes. So I'm Abby Silver. I am a writer, a lawyer, a mother of three boys, the youngest of three sisters. I grew up in Leeds, and although I no longer live up north, I gravitated down south quite a long time ago. Quite a big part of my heart is probably still up in the north, and I try to visit whenever I can. I became a lawyer, and then I became a writer. I suppose actually talking about it in that order perhaps isn't right, because I think I was always a writer. I was very lucky in that my father was an English teacher, so although my local library, Oakwood Library, was well stocked, you know, we had no shortage of books at home, and my sisters and I were always encouraged to read a lot. And I was always writing stories and poems, and a friend of mine used to come over on a Saturday afternoon and we would write plays.
Oh, wow, so fantastic.
I always enjoyed putting my thoughts down onto the page, but I suppose that, you know, career aspirations got in the way a bit. And so it wasn't until fairly recently, I'm sure we'll get onto it, but it wasn't until fairly recently that I actually tried to write a book and get it published. So I've been writing for years, but my first book, The Pinocchio Brief, came out in, I think, 2017.
Fantastic. So how did you transition from being a lawyer to author, published author?
It happened in a couple of stages, really. So first of all, going back, 20 odd years, I was on maternity leave. And I suppose that was the first time that I'd taken a bit of time out from legal work, although obviously I was quite busy. and we were also living overseas at the time, which had a sort of added complication. But during that period, I suppose I tried my hand at a few new things whenever I got a moment, which was usually really late at night. And one of those was writing. So I rediscovered my passion for writing, and I wrote something which I did think about getting published, but now sits in a drawer and may never see the light of day. But it was very much a kind of a practice run for what came next. And then we returned to the UK. I went back to legal work. I had two more children, so I was very busy. And it was only at the end of 2015 when I decided that I didn't really want to follow the traditional pattern. So I was a solicitor in a law firm, and there were things that didn't suit me. So I stopped, and I was looking for another job. And during that period, when I was looking, it took me a bit longer than I had hoped. And I sat down and I thought, I really want to use this time to write something that I can get published that people will enjoy reading. And that's when I wrote what became my first novel, The Pinocchio Brief.
So it was a natural progression, really, to write about something that you had worked in and were very familiar with, I suppose.
Yes. Although this is the criminal law, I'm actually, to admit, I'm not a criminal lawyer. I mean, I've always found criminal law fascinating. And the reason I became a lawyer in the first place, actually, was because I didn't know any lawyers, but I was very influenced by all the legal dramas on TV. So, and particularly Crown Court, which was a Granada TV production in the 70s and 80s. And I used to come home from school for my lunch and watch it in my lunch hour. So, you know, the criminal law, I think most people, if they think about law, they think about, you know, Crown Court trials, that kind of thing anyway. So I really wanted to write about those kind of things. And in some ways it's easier as well not to write directly about what I do in my yes. other job, because it's yes. all confidential stuff. So although I have to say that I do draw from my experiences in the law, obviously, and as a litigator, which is what I do, I am often in a courtroom. So, you know, I do understand the courtroom dynamics and I know what the judge does and that kind of thing.
So for anyone who hasn't come across your books, can you give us a little overview of the Burton and Lamb series, please?
Yes. So they are, I suppose, in one sense, a traditional courtroom drama with all the cut and thrust and theatricality of being in a courtroom. But in another sense, they're very modern. So each book focuses on a very topical theme and a different theme. So you can read each book as a standalone, but they do feature Judith Burton and Constance Lamb, who are the two lawyers who give their name to the series. And they meet in the first book when Constance, who is the younger, more modern, optimistic, sort of very determined solicitor, she instructs Judith, who is an older and I think probably more cynical and sometimes a little bit acid-tongued barrister. And so they come together for the first time in the Pinocchio brief. So if you read the books in order, you will see the development of their relationship. But equally, you can read each book. If you're particularly interested in one or other of the themes, you can take the books one at a time.
Yeah, for the audience, this is actually my first introduction to this series of books. So I have launched in at your one that we will talk about in a minute that is released this week. And so it's the first one I've read, but it's the fourth in the series, am I right?
That's correct.
Yeah, it's completely standalone. I absolutely know what's going on. I can follow every part of the story. You can see that there are things that have happened like any book in a series and kind of character developments, but it absolutely is very easy to read on its own right. And I've absolutely loved it. And I'm going back to read all the originals because I've enjoyed it so much. So you mentioned the first book in the series, The Pinocchio Brief. Sounds like a really interesting story based around assistive technology in criminal justice and how it can be used to aid decisions. Can you tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind that particular story, please?
Yes, of course. So the Pinocchio Brief, the Pinocchio name in the Pinocchio Brief is the nickname which is given to, as you've mentioned, a piece of software. So this is going to be used at trial under a new pilot scheme to watch how the accused moves his face, all those little facial cues that might give you away to decide whether he's telling the truth or not. And in the Pinocchio Brief, the accused is actually a young man who's been accused of murdering his teacher at a boys' private school in quite brutal fashion. And he's quite an unusual character as well, Raymond Maynard. What I try to do in each of my stories is they're generally a whodunit with lots of interesting suspects. But then there's an additional layer, which is, as I mentioned, my topical theme. So I very much wanted to address this idea of lie detecting software. And I want my readers to think about whether it's a good thing or not. So I try to introduce it in as balanced a way as possible. I often use Constance and Judith as my sort of two sides of the argument because they have a different approach to life. So generally speaking, Constance is in favour of all the new stuff. And generally speaking, Judith hates it. But, you know, they sometimes one learns from the other, which I think is what life is like. And certainly my experiences of working with people who you may not always agree with everything they say at the beginning, but you can learn things from them, definitely. So, but the inspiration came originally from an article in New Scientist magazine, which I love. I have always bought it for my kids, but I always read it. There's such interesting stuff in there about what's happening in the world and all the new things that potentially could help us in so many different ways. But the lie detecting software I find quite frightening. It's been actually more recently, so I was probably reading about this, if we think about timing, in sort of 2015, 2016. It has been used quite a lot. It's used in recruitment a lot. So you may not even know, but if you go for a job interview, you may be subjected to this scrutiny.
Oh, wow.
I'm told it's been used in the army as well to vet people. But quite recently, they were commenting again in New Scientist that there's not very much evidence that it's accurate. Mm. So that's one of the things I try and bring up in my story. But there's always an issue of whether we as humans are better at doing something or whether a machine is better at doing it. And we have our own shortcomings, of course. You know, we're not perfect. We might think we are, but we bring all our own prejudices and lack of knowledge, as well as knowledge, to everything we do. So those are the kind of things that I want people to think about when they read the book.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating subject. I think you could fill a whole podcast just on the talk of lie detection. You also suggest artificial intelligence in your book in the Aladdin trial. Have you got a particular interest in technology's part in the criminal justice?
I think it's more an interesting, so the first three books, so the Aladdin trial focuses on, so a poor lady, Barbara Hennessy, who is an artist, goes into hospital for a routine operation and she ends up dead on the ground 11 stories below, and her body's found, and there's then a whole debate about was she pushed, did she fall, has she been murdered? And I won't give too much away with the Aladdin trial, but in that book we are considering the issue of doctors dispensing medicine, artificial doctors, so robots, right, dispensing, yeah, medicine, as opposed to real doctors. And so I suppose that is another technology theme. In the Cinderella Plan, which is my third book, we move on really front and centre to address the whole issue of autonomous vehicles. So James Salisbury is an entrepreneur who has an awful fatal accident at the beginning of the book in his driverless car, and it's a car that his company is producing. So we've got this dilemma. He is tried for causing death by dangerous driving. And was it his fault or was it the car's fault? Was the car in control? Was he in control? So yes, you might be forgiven for thinking that this is all about technology. I think that my real interest, and when we come on to talk about the book published yesterday, The Rapunzel Act, this will become a bit more clear. But the link for me is more about new versus old. It's that wonderful call of the lamp seller in Aladdin, you know, new lamps for old, and our desire as human beings, I suppose, to grab hold of lovely new glittery things. But then sometimes we realise that they're not as wonderful as they were cracked up to be, and some elements of what came before were really better. So that's the kind of thing I like. So lie detectors, robots dispensing medicine, driverless cars, which personally I find absolutely terrifying, although yes. I don't like being a passenger in a car generally. I prefer to be in control. And in the new book, which I know we'll come on to, it's cameras in the courtroom. That's what we're talking about. So it's really all about, is the new way of doing things good, or should we stick with the old?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the topic for the Rapunzel Act is very different to the your earlier books, which, like you say, are very much technology based. But this is much more about people and the press and social media and all those kind of modern day trappings that we're in now. Can you tell us a bit more about the Rapunzel Act, which was published on the 15th of April 2021, which for us is yesterday, but for anyone listening further down the line, that's the date, so you can get that now. Can you tell us a little bit about this story?
Yes, so in the Rapunzel Act we have the brutal murder of Rosie Harper, who is a breakfast TV presenter and one half of what used to be a big celebrity couple. We all know a few of those celebrity couples out there today. And she's been found dead at home, and suspicion falls on her former spouse, who was in the past an international Premier League footballer, Danny Walks on Water Mallard, was how he was known when he was a footballer. But Danny has, over the last 2 years, transitioned to become Debbie, separated from Rosie, and has been living very quietly, managing a local women's football team. But Debbie is the prime suspect because her blood-drenched motorbike glove is found at the scene of the crime, and there are various other clues. And so Judith and Constance, my legal duo, have to come in and try and forge a successful defence for Debbie. But as we've mentioned, on top of all the usual challenges, we have a new pilot scheme where cameras are going to be brought into criminal trials in the UK, and Debbie's is going to be one of the first. And not only will the trial be filmed, but it will be live streamed, and there's going to be a new court TV channel set up, and the opportunity for lots of people to comment and analyse and say exactly what they think about the day's events whilst the trial is actually ongoing. And so, again, we've got the question of, was it Debbie or was it eco-campaigner Nikki Smith? Or was it co-presenter Jason Fenwick? Or was it one of Debbie and Rosie's children, Ben and Laura? Or was it Rosie's brother? I suppose that's probably the main suspect. There might, be some others. Tell me if I've missed any out. So we've got that. But I also want people to think about the impact of filming trials. It is actually a very real possibility that we will film trials here.
I was going to ask that question. Actually.
Yeah, I know. When I pitched the idea to my editor, he was really quite sceptical to start with. Obviously, trials in the USA have been filmed for years.
Right.
The O.J. Simpson trial and the book has a huge nod to the O.J. Simpson trial. I read a number of books about that trial, one in particular by Professor Paul Thaler, which focuses specifically on the impact that trial had on everybody involved when I was doing my writing. So America trials are filmed all the time. Over here, the last few years, the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court have been filmed, but that's very different. That's just a legal argument. And right. It's not criminal trials with witnesses. It's lawyers putting legal argument. You might remember Gina Miller's case in the Supreme Court, all about Brexit, was filmed. And the reason that there are very laudable motives, you know, people think that although courts are in theory open to the public, so you could walk along to Sheffield Magistrates Court, you know, and sit down and watch what's going on, that logistically it's quite difficult to do that. So there's very much this feeling that justice should be seen to be done, that we should make public courts really open to the public, that it would educate people, that it would make the system less scary, that it would maybe even stop lawyers being quite so aggressive with witnesses, and particularly with the focus on domestic violence and sexual assault and the low number of successful prosecutions, that maybe if people behaved a bit better in court towards victims, that would be helpful. So there are lots and lots of really laudable motives for moving this forward. And what happened in 2020 very quietly in June was that a law was passed in this country to enable criminal courts to be filmed, but only what the judge says when he's sentencing at the end of the trial. So that's sort of where we are. And I'm imagining taking it one step further and filming the whole trial. But for me, I always think with these things, you know, when you take the first step, it is the first step down a slippery slope. So I believe it genuinely could happen. And I suppose I want people to think about whether it's a good idea or not.
Yeah, and I think in the Rapunzel Act, you really intertwine a lot of different angles to that as well, because you have, obviously, Debbie is a celebrity, so you have that, and also the murder victim, Rosie, were both celebrities. So it's that kind of those pre-opinions that people already have formed, which is always difficult, I think, in any kind of legal case, but then if you've then got the public eye on them as well and having opinions, you've also got the so-called experts that come in and talk on the show that discusses the cases and whether there's any background around those. You know, there's all sorts of different threads that you put into it to show that it's not as straightforward as filming it and putting it out to the public. Was there anything about that that was particularly challenging to you to write?
I think with all my books, I mean, I spend quite a lot of time writing them, and I constantly go back over the chapters. I don't plan very much before I start writing. I sort of know where I'm going to start. I know what the general theme is going to be and maybe some of the ideas I want to get over. I sketch out my characters and then I sort of just start and see where they take me. So obviously the more different angles I want to bring in, the more complicated it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Incredibly complicated.
What I find is that I do sometimes spend quite a lot of time at the beginning of a session just reading back over what I've done. It sounds very silly, but you know, I have to get back into the groove and sort of remember what I've been writing and exactly where I am before I can move forward. The other thing I always agonize over is that I know that characterization is, you know, is really important, and that if, particularly when you write a series, people will fall in love with your characters, and that's what you want, so that they'll want to hear more from your characters. But I try really hard, because these are you know, they're legal thrillers, they're whodunits, there's got to be an interesting ending to who is responsible. So I agonize a lot over the whodunit and try to get an interesting twist at the end. And actually in this book and in the Aladdin trial, I changed whodunit part of the way through.
So, oh, that's interesting. You kind of always assume that somebody knows exactly what that plan is. So I love that you changed that depending on what you decide.
I did. And so then I always think it's quite funny, because I feel like I definitely wouldn't have given away too many clues whilst I was writing it, because I didn't know who was the killer myself.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to say, for a book that has so many strands to it, so many different threads, lots of different characters, but it is so easy to follow. It's so quick. There isn't a sentence that doesn't feel like it belongs there. And is that hard to edit? Because surely if you're, you know, everything in there feels really vitally important to the story. That hard to edit a book like this?
I don't really know the answer to that. It's just how I work. I do constantly go back over it over and over again. So I don't know how other people work, but my first draft isn't really a first draft. When it goes to my editor, I've gone over it many, many times before I've decided I want to submit it. I mean, essentially my first draft is what I think is pretty good. Of course, then what happens is it goes to the editor and he pulls me up on, you know, it tends to be on big points of, is this plausible? Would this character say this? That kind of thing. Not on the real details, but those kind of plot points and character points. And of course, it's funny when you're wrapped up in it, you don't see it. But as soon as someone else points things out to you, you think, oh, yes, of course, of course. So, I do a lot of work on editing. And then obviously there's an editor, and then there's a copy editor right at the end who tries to pick up on the really small details to make sure that everything's consistent. And then, of course, because I'm writing a series, I have to make sure it's consistent. This book is consistent with the ones that have come before in terms of all the details, where people live, what they like to eat, what their family, members of their family, what their names are, those kind of things. So you have to keep track of those things too.
And I think I read in an interview that you said that every book that you write about a topic that you have an initial interest in that sparks your kind of excitement. And I think that's really important as well in terms of keeping track and enjoying writing the book and enjoying editing, because it's a long, old, heavy process, really, by the sounds of it.
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, I just hope, in some ways it's a bit immodest, but you know what, I find something that I think is really fascinating, so I just hope then that if I think it's interesting, that readers will think it's interesting too.
Well, I did, so I think it works. So the defendant in your case is a transgender female, which you mentioned before, called Debbie. It can be quite a sensitive topic in its own right in a story like this. And I think there's things that have come up with other books that contain transgender characters. And I think you've made sure that the community is represented accurately whilst also recognising and identifying potential prejudices that she faces in this kind of environment under spotlight. How did you approach that?
Yeah, so obviously I was aware of the sensitivities, but at the same time, I thought writing Debbie's character was really important. I suppose I could name at least two reasons. I mean, first of all, I think representation in books is really important.
Yes.
So my books are set today. They're set in London, which is a rich and culturally diverse city. So I begin with the premise that it's right that my books are peopled with sort of rich, diverse characters. And as I say, I think representation is important generally, but particularly then if you're writing something modern. I read this wonderful interview from a few years back with Laverne Cox in Time magazine, and she's the star of Orange is the New Black. So she is an African-American trans woman who was saying then, this was 5 or 6 years back, how important she thought it was for people in the trans community to live visibly. And she made a wonderful comment about how if you were telling your stories, you were humanizing them, and that removed, that demystified differences. And I know that what she was doing was obviously she was telling her own story, and that's hugely important. But I think fiction has a part to play too in really in dispelling prejudices, in educating people. With fiction, it's interesting. You can perhaps publicly sort of laugh things off and say, ha ha, it's just fiction. But at the same time, you might privately identify with some of the things that you see. So it's a really good way of getting a message across. So that's one reason for writing Debbie. I think another was just that I wanted to, that her character suited my story. We've already mentioned that there was a more than a nod to the O.J. Simpson story.
Yes.
And in O.J.'s case, the whole issue of race became the defining factor in the trial. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to modernise and come up with a new angle with my story. And so it seemed to me that another potentially polarising issue for this country in 2021 would be the whole issue of whether a trans woman could get a fair trial in circumstances where she and her former spouse were, as you say, celebrities, and there's intense media and social media scrutiny. So those are all things I wanted to address in the story. I did an awful lot of reading. I mean, I research all my characters to a certain degree and all my plots. I suppose I use as much research as I think I need to make the characters well-rounded, all the plots plausible. This time I read a number of magazine articles, books. I went on a website for All About Trans, which is a really informative website run by a charity which tries to promote the way that trans people are represented in the media. And that has all sorts of real life stories on there, which are very useful and informative. And I also spent some time talking to a local trans woman who was really happy to share her experiences with me and who kindly read the book as well. So that was what I did. I suppose one other factor, which wasn't a particular hardship, I have to say, was I don't generally write the suspects from the first person. So I wrote Debbie, apart from the very beginning of the book where we have the prologue, I wrote her as other people viewed her, which I hope also means that I've been more sensitive to the issues which could arise. But it wasn't, I'm also very conscious of the fact that we shouldn't be censoring what we write as writers. It's really important generally that we can say.
So looking at your lead characters now, Judith and Constance, Burton and Lamb, I found it to be a really human look at Judith in particular, this book, because you get some insights into how she's thinking, you know, when she's worried about her crow's feet and having to perform, because obviously being a lawyer, I guess it is part performance, isn't it? But there's a lot of kind of work and intelligence and all sorts behind that. And then also there's the question marks over her head as to whether the person she's defending is actually innocent as well, which is a really interesting little kind of snippet there. Did you deliberately set out to spotlight the legal duo's personal feelings and lives in these books more so than the kind of surrounding cast? Because it seems like you really get a close spotlight on them.
Yes. I mean, I think this is the Burton and Lamb series. It is about Judith Burton and Constance Lamb and the work they do as professional women. And you just have more time, I suppose, with them because they run through the four books. So I don't have to tell their whole story in one book as I might for the suspect or one or other of the witnesses. I can take my time and give you a little bit in each book, and then obviously it can be more in depth. And I did want to address that the human side. I think there's always this feeling, and I know it myself, that you see someone else perform really well, whatever they're doing, and you kind of think it comes easy for them. It's really easy for them. It's difficult for me, but it's easy for them. Mm-hmm. And I've learned over the years that really isn't the case. Okay. That if somebody performs really well, of course experience plays a part, but they've usually really put the hours in.
Yeah.
So and I always remember from years ago when I was really new as a lawyer and just terrified at some of the things that I had to do when perhaps I had to approach somebody very, very senior to give me a witness statement, you know, when I was very new, is just remembering that everybody is human. You know, they all get up in the morning and brush their teeth kind of thing. Yes. They're just like you. And that really helped me get through some of those challenging moments when I was very junior, is just to think they're not so different. Yeah. So I do to try and bring that out as well in the stories, that of course Judith stands up and she performs fantastically well and everybody says how great she is, but privately she's worried too, especially when the cameras are watching her and she knows that she can't just close the door at the end of the day and go home, but this she might be watching herself, so she worries too.
So you've written several books based on this duo now. Did you have a clear direction in terms of where you're taking them? Or are you just, is it book by book in terms of how these characters develop?
So it's probably more book by book than having a clear direction. So I have actually written book 5, which is coming out in August. So there will be a fifth book, The Midas Game, which is going to be out, I think, digitally in June and in paperback the 5th of August. Awesome. In that story, I take a detailed look at online gaming and all the potential pitfalls of online gaming, together with some of the possible benefits. So we have the death of a doctor, which initially is thought to be by natural causes, but then the main suspect turns out to be a local gamer and YouTuber who had befriended this doctor. So that's how we start. So that probably gives you an idea of how I'm using another topical contemporary theme. I am writing book 6, so I know how far, you know, where we're going up to book 6, but I haven't particularly thought of further than that. I do very much like with my characters to let them dictate things a bit. So I maybe have an idea of a couple of characters who will come back if they've been characters that readers have liked, but I haven't gone much further than that. So there is going to be 5, hopefully there'll be a 6, and then we'll just see what happens after
fantastic.
That
fantastic, excellent. I'm looking forward to finding out how they develop. You've spoken about a lot of the things you've read as part of your research. What kind of books do you enjoy reading yourself, and who has inspired you, if anybody, to write?
So I read all sorts of things now. I try to read a lot of modern crime fiction because obviously that's the sphere in which I'm operating. But I also read more widely. In terms of influence, I mean, clearly all the Sherlock Holmes stories, which I read.
Yes.
When I was much younger, I used to have I still have somewhere in here. I have this huge illustrated volume of Sherlock Holmes, which I used to read under the pillow late at night. So Those stories I absolutely love, and also read to my kids, which was another lovely way of revisiting them. In terms of things that I like to read now, I like Kate Atkinson very much. Mm. I suppose what I really like is that she has her crime stories, the Jackson Brodie novels, mm. but then she's also written other things, and
yeah,
I think it's rather nice not to always feel that you have to write in the same genre. So I really liked her Behind the Scenes at the Museum, which I read when it first came out some time ago now, which is sort of part memoir and family saga and all those kind of things with lots of humour in it. I do try with my own books, actually. I mean, I hope maybe you found that they address serious subjects, but yeah. they're not dark, and there is quite not a lot of humour in them, yes. I hope.
There was one little bit that I really chuckled at, and I was going to write it down at the time to kind of go, I need to mention that in the podcast, and I've completely forgot to write it down. But I have, there's been lots of moments where I've really smiled through the book, and yeah, there's lots of lightness in them.
I like Joanne Harris. Her yes. books are so quirky. So she comes up with just the most amazing characters. I like historical fiction a lot. So I like Tracy Chevalier. In the crime sphere, then Antonia Hodgson has written some great historical crime, and Laura Shepherd Robinson. So, I mean, and there are many, many books. If you look at the CWA long list, so the Crime Writers Association, they've just produced their long lists, and there are some fantastic books on there, which are all in competition for the awards for this year.
Yeah.
So. Lots of those, but it's very hard to, as you can imagine, to be doing everything. So I try and have books on the go and to keep up. We're just so lucky, aren't we, that we have access to so many wonderful writers.
Mm. Do you fancy dabbling in other genres, or are you going to stick to the legal thrillers?
I do a bit, yes. Mm. So we'll get to book six. Mm-hmm. I suppose it depends how I have some ideas for writing some other Excellent. Kind of stories. But it's a question of time, really, and time to develop those.
Okay, well, for anybody who would like to follow you and your future writings and what might come out, and Burton Lamb series, of course, where can we find you, please?
So I do have a website, which is abbysilver.co.uk. I am on Facebook as Abby Silver Author. I'm on Twitter as Abby Silver 16. So that's all very easy. So you can find me in all those places. My publisher is iBooks, I and Lightning. So that's I as in your I, E-Y-E, i-books.com, where you can find more about me and all my books. And you can always get in touch through my publisher if you can't find me on one of those other channels.
Fantastic, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's been really lovely chatting to you. The Midas Game is released in digital format in June, am I right? And then paperback in August 2021.
That's right, thank you.
And then the Rapunzel Act was published in paperback yesterday, 15th of April 2021. So get your hands on those, and the other books in the series are all available. And they've had a facelift, haven't they?
Yeah, no, they have. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Thank you for coming on. It was lovely to talk to you.
My guest today was Abby Silver. You have been listening to the Sheffield Libraries podcast, the place to hear authors discuss their work, to explore stories, fact and fiction that we think deserve to be heard. I hope you'll join us again.